Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Ho, ho, ho! Now I have a machine gun. Oh, wait. Wrong episode. Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 120, with guests Real World Theology's Mark Wingerter and Alexis Johnson. And we've got a really great bonus Christmas episode for you this year. On this episode, we talk It's a Wonderful Life and Fighting for Joy.
So, what do you do for Christmas, Alexis? Do y'all have traditions?
Well, no. Last year was actually like our first kind of actual Christmas, even though January we'll have been married 5 years. But we didn't really, because we had apartments, and even the last year in an apartment, we just were finally like, you know what? Let's just finally do it. We want to do stuff. We want to have a more traditional Christmas, like. Mm-hmm. Not a commercial, stupid Christmas. I was like, let's get ourselves a tree. Like, so we invested in the stuff, and now our cats are destroying it this year. So, mm-hmm.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah. Merry Christmas. No, they're not that bad. I mean, I've seen worse on YouTube, that's for sure. yeah, but they are young. They're, you know, about a year. They're young. They're little guys. But yeah, so we just decided. But I do an advent calendar. I bought like one you can use every year. Mm-hmm. And so last year I put Christmas quotes in it and candy for him. Like I just do it for him. And then this year I put sort of like, you know, cutesy lovey quotes for him. Like, so every year I'm going to put a new quote or something for him in there with a piece of candy to open every day for 25 days or whatever. Mm. So that's, I guess, a tradition, you know, we're starting, but we're still new to it.
Well, so what did it look like before? You just were like, oh, we're in an apartment. I guess we won't even buy each other presents because, but humbug.
Oh, no, we bought presents and stuff, but we just didn't really decorate, or we would go just be with my family, you know, extended family. So
there's it wasn't. Y'all wouldn't stay up on Christmas Eve and watch a Christmas movie, or you wouldn't, like, there were no traditions.
I guess we did watch movies, but it wasn't like, oh, this is our thing every year. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just, we were just figuring it out. But yeah, of course we got each other a little something, and you know, it was nice, but now it's definitely more of like a thing. Like we decorate and we're more intentional about it because I know it was just, when we worked for the movie theaters, it was rough. Like life was like just blur of, mm-hmm. ugh. So, yeah, so that's kind of, we're starting there, but I went to, I love the UK, and hopefully, cross my fingers, might be able to go back soon with him. But I lived there for about 7 months. I made 2 trips, and I got to be there for Christmas both times. And that was just amazing because it was very Dickens-y, you know, like it's very, very traditional, mm-hmm. you know, traditional down to like the weird Christmas pudding, which isn't really pudding, and like mm-hmm. the little mince pies, like all that pudding. Kind of stuff.
Yeah, Christmas crackers.
Oh yeah, that was wonderful. Yeah, it was just like, it was so magical, and I just really loved it. And that kind of, it was my early 20s, and that kind of rekindled Christmas for me, because you know, late teens were kind of hard, so I was like, Christmas sucks. I went through that phase. And, you know, but then I was like, no, this is great. And so now I'm glad that we're starting to build our own ones now that we have more space and kind of have more of a rhythm with life and everything. So
Well, yeah. The way you describe it, I imagine that every day was just like going to the Biltmore House in Asheville for Christmas, because they really, it's this huge mansion, like the largest private home in America mm-hmm. or something like that. Mm-hmm. And when they decorate it for Christmas, it's just, it's crazy awesome. And
where is it at?
It's in Asheville, North Carolina.
I heard it's beautiful there.
It's, yeah, it's really pretty up there. And this particular, this, the house and the grounds and everything, they have like, one of those huge Christmas trees, like you would see like at the White House, kind of mm-hmm. like in the middle of the lawn, like this, like lawn sprout, like movies have been filmed, like Richie Rich was there, like that was supposed to be like his house. Like, and they filmed a number of other films there too, because like I said, it's a big, huge freaking, like it's a big, big estate house.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah,
it's bigger than Downton Abbey. Let's just be real.
Oh man.
But
Downton's
yeah.
like a spring home for
it is. It is. Yeah. So I really wish we could go there more often. I realize all we do is like walk through the house, but there's something in the atmosphere that just, it feels like Christmas. Whatever they do, whatever it is, I can't walk through that house. I can't even, like, as soon as I step onto like that front lawn, that's like, I mean, it really is like 200 yards or something like that. I step onto it, it's dark, I see the lights and all the windows and candles, and it just feels like Christmas. But but I'm interested to see what we're doing this year. I believe last year we talked on the podcast about kind of like what we talked every year on the Christmas episode, just about some of our Christmas traditions. And I know I've talked about what we did before, and I'm interested to see now that we have a son, how that's going to change, because it's a lot less enticing to stay up after the Christmas Eve service and watch Die Hard. Because we were already getting kind of old and being like, I don't know if I want to stay up till 1 o'clock on Christmas Eve. So trying to fit our annual Christmas movie in somewhere. We had just 2 years ago or so started a tradition, or three years ago, we had started a tradition, Laura and I, of, on Christmas Day, we would get up, we would make cinnamon rolls, we would open presents by ourselves. And then we would go see a movie, because we basically started this tradition when I started Real World.
Yeah,
so
sure.
It worked out very well.
Sounds about right.
And then we get Chinese food, and then we go to my family's house and do the family thing. It was and it was great, and we loved
Christmas
it.
But story.
But no,
I'm gonna throw all these Easter eggs in.
I was saying, like, no one this. I guess at some point we will probably cover A Christmas Story, and I guess I will have to have Gene on. He seems pretty adamant about
you'll
that.
You'll have to have Gene on.
I guess you'll
it's
have
funnier
to.
When you don't
it's
have
funny
Gene
when
on.
I don't have
yeah.
Gene.
Yeah, you should give it to anyone but Gene.
No, that was well. So I would say that the thing that I could do that would be fair is in early December, I will consult my list. I will check it twice. And I will find out how naughty or nice Gene has been that year. And that will be his Christmas present. So
my guess is very naughty.
Naughty, usually been... naughty.
I was about to say, you might as well check him off. Naughty.
Oh, I hope Gene appreciates that. So yeah, I'm not sure what our Christmas traditions are going to be this year, but...
And it'll take time, because I mean...
Yeah,
I have a two-year-old, and she's... I mean, we still don't like... have a tradition yet.
Yeah. You know? So, we do the tree. We you know, obviously we do things like that.
I mean,
but...
she helped us a little bit with we do Christmas cookies. That's our tradition. Mm-hmm. My wife's a baker. She does all these Christmas cookies, and we decorate the traditional ones. And
yet you're here and I have no cookies.
Yeah. How about that? I ate them all. So,
oh, yeah. I do that actually.
Yeah.
I mean, with my family, make a lot of cookies. My mom's family is like hardcore. I mean, it was my grandmother who passed away last year. She was like this gourmet connoisseur. Like, she was just amazing at cook, you know, not just, you know, everyone thinks their grandma's the best cook, but my grandma really was the best cook. And so we do like a huge cookie baking thing every year, just me and the ladies and our family. And it's fun. I'm not particularly that talented at the making part. I do the decorating. I get pretty crazy.
There you go.
I was hoping you were going to say, like, I'm pretty good at the eating part, though.
Yeah.
Like, when it comes to eating
well,
the cookies,
that too.
I do my part.
But yeah.
This year, I manned the oven, so, hey, that was work.
There you go.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, it's interesting to see how our traditions grow and change, and as I was prepping for this episode... I am watching It's a Wonderful Life, which I have seen a number of times. I've probably seen half a dozen times over, you know, my lifetime. Mm-hmm. And I notice that every time I watch it, as I age, like, it hits me harder and harder every time. And it just makes me really glad that we picked it to do this year for Christmas.
It is the 70th anniversary of the film.
Oh yeah, it is the 70th anniversary of the film.
This week.
Which amazing.
You know, I usually prefer to do films on their 73rd anniversary, but I just couldn't wait. You know, arbitrary anniversaries for the win.
Yeah.
And I finished the movie and I was like, why is this not something that I watch every year?
Yeah.
And then, I mean, it becomes obvious to me, I believe. And I think that answer usually ends up kind of like I've already said, like, Die Hard is our family Christmas movie that we definitely watch every year, but we barely find time to watch it. How am I going to fit, like...
I can't wait for, like, 4-year-old John Luke to, you know, watch Die Hard. It's the family Christmas movie, buddy. Now I have a machine gun.
Yeah, well, that's the
thing. Well, if it is a Christmas movie.
Even stir that.
It obviously is.
Hey, buddy, welcome to the potty, pal. Sorry.
But it would still be a movie that we probably end up watching after he goes to bed, sure. Even when he's 4. But, you know, like, I want to always fit more of these movies in, because I really do love Christmas movies. And, like I said, every time I watch one, like, we were cleaning up downstairs the other day, and I had Charlie Brown Christmas on, and I was like, oh my gosh, this movie is so good. It's so simple. Because then you watch the other one that comes on the DVD, which is like, it's Christmas Again, Charlie Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this is terrible. This is so bad. It's like, they were like, we got to try really hard this time. I was like, no, the reason Charlie Brown Christmas is so good is because it's so simple. So I'm wanting to watch It's a Wonderful Life. I don't know if I want to watch it, or part of me doesn't want to watch it because I don't want to basically sit and weep.
Mm-hmm.
Like with my head in my hands, like for that long once a year. But yeah. I do.
It's good for the soul.
It's just amazing. And Mark and I were talking about this before the show, that it's pretty crazy that this show or this movie was made in 1946.
46. I mean, like, that's
like, I when I think about this, I'm like, oh yeah, it's probably like 30 years old or something. Like. They're, you know, different times a little bit, but, you know, still kind of like things in this movie are like, it seems like every year they become more culturally relevant or more personally relevant than the year before.
I mean, it's like,
I agree.
It's like, you forget how long ago that is. I mean, 70 years. Mm-hmm. So really, I mean, that, like you said before the show, that was right after the end of the war, World War II, you know, like that's, it's so long. I mean, of course, there are so many great movies from, you know, every era of the 1900s. But, you know, just something that this has endured this long, I mean, is amazing. And so, you know, I know the reception originally was a little bit different, but
So I think that's kind of like my first real question about this film, because, like I said, when I'm sitting there watching it, I watch this opening scene. Or montage, kind of, and it's a whole bunch of people like praying, like earnestly praying, and while I would say the spirituality of the film is more like feel goodism than it is a specific religion, it certainly alludes to kind of semi Christian-y things, if not more myth than whatever. But that kind of aside the point, it seems like there is a very upfront, I don't want to say no nonsense, but unapologetic religious tone to the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm sitting there wondering, does this movie get made today?
No, I don't think so.
So why not? Like,
I'll let Alexis answer first.
Well, thank you.
Well, no, I don't. Okay, so let me set that up better. Generally, if you're on Skype, you answer first. That's kind of the etiquette that we established. So,
I'll
let you go first. I don't want to talk too much.
Well, okay, so Alexis, if someone pitches an idea like this to you today, do you back it if you're a producer?
Oh, I would. Yeah.
You would. Totally. Why would you? Why would you back it?
Well, because I mean, not everyone knows who's listening, but you guys know that I want to go into the film and television industry, and I've been trying to. For a while. But yeah, I would definitely back that, because even though I believe this is based off of a book. Oh, my brain's dying. It's based off of something else, I think. The actual story, It's a Wonderful Life. But it's very, you know, especially in light of today's culture, it's a very standout, very unique sort of film. But it has some of the old storytelling methods. Like, it kind of reminds you of A Christmas Carol in the way of, you know, how it goes through some sort of imaginary premise for a while and you have to follow him on that journey, kind of a dreamlike thing. But yeah, I would back it completely because, like you said, it remains relevant, you know, even 70 years later with totally different circumstances and different culture. It remains relevant. And it actually grew more relevant over the years because, yeah, even if it did bomb at the box office, which is very unfortunate, but it's one of those like snowball effects where it just, yeah, over the years, why it became a classic is because people thought about it. Maybe they didn't think about it the year it came out, maybe not even the year after, but people let it resonate with them for a while. And that's what the kind of movie I want to make is not something people are going to enjoy, you know, like popcorn and say, what's next? Something they're really going to savor, something that's really going to stay with them, that's going to be carried in their heart, you know? So that's why I would back it.
So I take it back. I think this movie would get made.
No, okay. I want to ask, because I think I know where you're going to go with this.
Uh-huh.
And I want to get Alexis there. And if I don't go in the right place, then I'll let you jump in. So
I want this to be my thought.
I know. I also don't want you to hit the table.
Sorry.
But that's... You know, we don't always get what we want for Christmas. Just ask Gene. So I'm wondering as a clarification question.
Is the subhead for this one gonna be It's a Wonderful Life and all the things that we do to make Gene mad?
I love the fact that in general, a podcast can grow a community to a point where people understand like references to other things.
Yeah.
I think that's one of my favorite things. So I hope people know who Gene is and I hope you think that's funny. Anyway. So Alexis, as a follow-up question, I'm wondering if you're saying you would make this movie having seen the movie and saying, yes, having seen this movie, I would definitely back it again. Cause I could say, yes, I've seen this movie. I would definitely do whatever I could to get this to as many people as possible. Cause I think they would love it. But I'm wondering if if either you hadn't seen this movie and someone pitched it to you, or you weren't backing this movie, you were going to a studio and saying, and you've seen this movie, and you say, you're trying to pitch it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't show them the film. How do you pitch this movie to a production company or a studio or whatever, and not make it sound like a hokey, terrible Christian film?
Oh gosh, we'll see how this is good practice for what I have later on this year, Pitching Fest. So yeah, it would be, you are right though. It would be incredibly difficult to pitch this film without it sounding hokey and cheesy, you know, which at times, granted, there are some moments like that in the film.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Overall, I wouldn't say like it's overall cheesy, hokey. But yeah, it would be, I think you'd have to, and I can't really do this right now on the spot. If I could think about it, maybe I would, but just to really filter it down to the most basic, but I guess meatiest aspect of it, you know, because I think men can relate to it a lot, obviously, with George Bailey and the weight on his shoulders. But I find myself occasionally relating to George Bailey too, because I'm a dreamer who's feeling stuck in, you know, this routine life, this, you know, American dream sort of cogs in metropolis sort of thing going on that we have here. And I can understand and sympathize and empathize with that character. So I think characters really are what sell. And I would try to sell that character and his, you know, relative life and how that would, you know, appeal to audiences. Because yeah, if you try to sell it too much on the story and what happens, it would sound rather cheesy and it might not make it past the table, I guess, or the room, the first room that you'd have to bring it to.
Well, so, okay. Yeah. So that's kind of where I was going, but the further end of it was like, yes, I think this movie would get made because the culture right now as far as making, and we're talking, of course, without nuance. We're talking, mm-hmm. you know, that on a large scale, big budget, people would see this, you know, movie. It would mm-hmm. be produced at a major studio.
They changed the name to Collateral Beauty.
Yeah, basically.
Oh God.
Oh boy. I'm gonna leave that one to the side. I could run on that one for a second.
But yes, you see what I'm saying, though.
I do, and
because
I
feels think, like it would get made, but in one of two ways.
Here's the deal. Okay. It would get made. I feel like there would be a drastically different result, which I feel like mm-hmm. is obvious. But the mm-hmm. but the exploration of that is culturally, our culture is much more broad, open. In terms of spirituality, it was much more closed at the time to being primarily a Christian culture, mm-hmm. Permeated lots of things, especially so close to the war. It was primarily a Christian culture. And so this, you see this, it's not just It's a Wonderful Life. This was like a fluke of like, oh my gosh, there's so much, you know, Christian spirituality things going on. That was in a lot of films back then. And, you know, I think that that's a just part and parcel for the times. Nowadays, everything that is kind of pushed Christian with that kind of, any kind of that has that spiritual background is pushed into a genre because mm-hmm. Christian spirituality now in films is just a money-making point. It's mm-hmm. just a, okay, we can market it to this audience, which I'm not making a commentary on necessarily. That's just the way it is. I think what's missing then is that organic, this feels natural. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you know, it's funny watching this movie and you know, George is, you know, having trouble with his car and, you know, so you see a lot of his car and him interacting with it. And this car is, you know, this old car, but it's like, oh my gosh, that's a really old car. But like, that was the car he was driving at the time. You know, this is not a period piece. I know we're going mm-hmm. back into his life in the early 1900s, but his, you know, in the present day in this film, it's the 40s. It's an old car. I found that really, really fascinating. But it's definitely just a different time. And so I don't know where I was going with that. I think I lost my train of thought. But I think the spirituality is different. You get that organic feel from that because that's the way people felt about things in life and reacted to things in life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just, let's make this a Christian film because there's an angel in it and that's what drives the story. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's an organic nature to things when you throw Tim McGraw in a movie.
Yeah.
It's generally going to have that kind of like a forced feel that mm-hmm. we're just like, you know, some of the like, you know, there's kind of like mass marketed spiritual films that don't have that like, altar call at the end, you know, kind of thing where like mm-hmm. the hero gives his life to Jesus. Like those movies are even worse because they have this, that forced in, it's not organic. It's like, I mm-hmm. need to give my life to Jesus cause I'm a sort of an anti-hero, but we can't have that be the end, you know? So there's a lot of like inorganic, spirituality on the screen this, you know, these days that I think there's something very personal in this movie that comes across. And I think as time goes on, as the culture gets, you know, more diverse, spiritually, religiously, or whatever, I think that authenticity speaks more than the spirituality itself. Than mm-hmm. I'm praying to God, I'm a Christian, I go to church, that kind of thing. I think it's more of like, he's really feeling this. Like, this is actually what he believes. This is actually what George Bailey believes mm-hmm. because, you know, Jimmy Stewart believed it. You know, I think there's that connection there that we miss a lot these days.
Yeah, I definitely like what you said about, I think the idea that if someone made this film today, they would try to kind of shove it into almost a box.
Yeah, yeah.
And so mm-hmm. it does feel like that if it was made today, one of two things would happen. Mm-hmm. Either it would be picked up by a Christian film studio and all the semi-ambiguous kind of spirituality, the supernaturalness of the film would be kind of straightened up and straightened out, and it would definitely be like very Christian, and it wouldn't be like ambiguously like
mm-hmm.
anything like everything would be blatant. Kind of like you're saying, like Tim McGraw would show up and it would be blatant.
It wouldn't, you know, it just wouldn't be just like natural, like just kind of a part of the scene. It would have to be the focus.
Yeah.
That's, you know.
Or, because they were saying if, you know, we want this to be like, we want to show like God, it's the only way to show God is to be very blatant about it. Mm-hmm. Or it would be picked up by a secular studio and they would say, well, all that spiritual stuff, it's just too vague. It's too, it seems too much like Christianity, and it's not inclusive enough. And so it ends up fitting into more of a.
Say it's not vague enough. Like you need to like water it down.
Well, so they would make it so vague that it would turn into a purely humanistic movie.
Right.
Where like you just need to realize that the people around you are all you need, and you have the ability to love your life inside you, mm-hmm. you know, like, and just tap into that. So, like, I feel like it would push it to one of those extremes, whereas I think the reason It's a Wonderful Life sticks around is because it's not swinging either of those ways fully. It's actually saying, hey, we're not really concerned about the rules of this world. We're concerned about the struggle that this man is going through and how that connects with like the everyday man trying to struggle with his own existence.
Yeah, because I mean, like what you said about it, if it ended up being kind of a humanist bent, it's kind of, you know, it doesn't end up with a humanist bent, but it's still the plot point where the story ends up. Like, what you need, what is important is the people that are around you, your community, these things that you care about. It really doesn't make any points about God. It doesn't make any points about him being spiritual. That's just there. Like, that's just part of the story. You know, and really, I mean, if you're getting into the theological applications, the idea of an angel getting his wings is not really lining up. You know, it's a little bit...
I was going to say, it's more...
A little bit out of the box.
It's more like, oh yeah, that kind of sounds like an idea that sounds pretty.
Right.
Like that's exactly how I imagine someone describing it.
Right.
Like, oh, that's sweet.
Uh-huh.
You know?
And so, you know, theologically... It definitely doesn't make any points because it's just like, it really is just a fantasy. I mean, it's a fantasy story in essence with this backbone.
Well, actually, it almost seems like a sci-fi story to me. Because I think it's doing what sci-fi is supposed to do, which is give you a world that has rules that are not the rules that we play by.
Mm-hmm.
And all the rules aren't there to make you think about the rules. They're there to make you understand humanity better.
Yeah.
So while I don't think you're going to ever find It's a Wonderful Life filed under the sci-fi genre, I think, you know, there's something there. As far as what it's getting to.
Well, and it's, you know, and Alexis, please jump in at any point.
But, I think she tried to cut her off.
Yeah.
Oh, I have a thought.
Okay, go ahead. All right.
Well, because you're showing these two options. There's the Christianese option where we're going to get Fireproof 3. Mm-hmm. And then there's the option we have with the studio where we're going to get Collateral Beauty, this like sort of, you know, quasi-spiritual or whatever, I don't know, whatever, this sort of muddled mess of like ideas. That
none of us really know because we would not go watch it.
Yeah, none of us have seen that.
Yeah, no.
But there's a third option. And this is the option that I believe in, which is to be independent, to make the film independently. And that doesn't mean indie film. That's like kind of its own, that's like a genre label. But to make an independent film means it's being made, you know, creatively by a team that truly believes in the story or in what they're making. And that can change the tone and the reception, you know, remarkably, because there are a lot of films that were made by small people or, you know, small groups that ended up being Oscar winners, you know, or ended up being like, you know, in the limelight, or just things that ended up, you know, skyrocketing into the box office starting from nothing. Not that they have to, because I don't think a movie has to be successful, you know, with just by monetary means. But the third option of being independent, as myself going, you know, you do need to have people to back you financially or whatever to make the film. So you'd have to pitch it still, but we could make a film like this today with the realism and the grit and the, you know, the truth of life and the Christian themes, but without being too preachy or having an agenda or, you know, putting it in a way that, yeah, like the altar call at the end kind of stuff, or also by watering down reality by like bleeping out all the F-bombs or whatever you got to do, mm-hmm. like, you know, just stuff like that. It's not that you have to make things, you know, yeah. overkill, but you just got to be realistic and show like this guy, like a guy like George Bailey today would be rough to watch and we'd all relate to him. Mm-hmm. It'd be great.
Well, yeah, and I think we're getting into the nuance of the original question of like, yeah, I mean, I feel like an independent film could be made of this and the true, like, just independence from major studio as that is defined. I think you could conceivably say, yes, that could be made. I mean, and not to knock, you know, the major studio system. I mean, that's the reason why these things get bent one way or get bent one another is because there's now so much money behind all of these films that they have to make sure that they hit the widest audience to get the most amount of money. I mean, that's got its good and bad things. You know, we get, you know, really visually stunning films out of it, and so there's good and bad. But what I want to know is, why did you originally ask the question, Fizz? Because it was your question, and now we're getting into the, like, all the nuance of, like, so what did you want to advance that, or?
No. So, I mean, so the backbone of this question is, it struck me. Like, I think it'd been 2 or 3 years since I'd seen It's a Wonderful Life, maybe 4, I don't know. Probably since, I probably have not watched it since I started the podcast. So since mm-hmm. I really started doing the film and theology thing, really trying to examine or help others examine, and watching it now, having watched so many movies, especially Christmas movies, mm-hmm. I just don't see blatant spirituality very commonplace. Again, not necessarily Christianity and It's a Wonderful Life, but like, just like I said, I was like, oh, everyone is like earnestly praying at the beginning of this movie. And there's lots of quotes, or allusions to like Bible verses mm-hmm. throughout the film. Mm-hmm. And I'm just mm-hmm. like, I would not see this today. And if I saw it, it does, like, sure, the third way that you're beating the drum for, Alexis, mm-hmm. that to me is like the, you know, if you make a movie in the forest and no one's around to see it, does it really exist? Like, do I want people to make movies and appreciate the art and do what their vision is? Yes. But I think practically, and like, you know, 99% of the cases, most, like, someone trying to make this movie today is going to end up in one of those two camps. Mm-hmm. They're going to end up, like, mm-hmm. trying to pitch it to a Christian studio as a Hallmark film, or they're going to try to pitch it to a major studio, and it's not going to come out like It's a Wonderful Life. And I think the way It's a Wonderful Life came out mm-hmm. is the only way that it could have come out and still be a movie worth talking about for 70 years.
Yeah, oh, I agree.
Yeah.
So it's, like I said, I asked it just because I was wondering, is anyone as shocked as me that like we have a film that seems to defy the two ways that films are getting made today? Mm-hmm. And it seems like we are kind of saying, you know, it would be very hard to make this film today. We would love if someone did, mm-hmm. but it's difficult. So that's a surprise for me, but I'm also sitting in this idea that I'm really loving the film, watching it through again. Mm-hmm. It's like I said, to the point where, one, I'm weeping like a, mm-hmm. like a small child. Mm-hmm. And, two, that I love it so much that I want to figure out a way to watch this every year mm-hmm. to not forget what I'm seeing. So I have reasons that I'm kind of contemplating why I am loving this film. And the reason that we're here, honestly, is because I want to know why you guys love this film. Uh-huh. So just kind of feel free to paint with a broad brush. Feel free to nail it down to a single thing. Mm-hmm. But I want to swing the doors wide, and Alexis, I want to know what it is about It's a Wonderful Life that you connect with in this film.
Okay. Well, first off, I want to tell you, you can watch this movie any time of year, because I don't really know that I consider it a Christmas movie. It just features Christmas in the end. But that being said, it's more about a person's life. I feel like you could watch this any time of year. you know, it's not really a seasonal thing and you can just get so much out of it. For me, I really connect to George Bailey, like I was telling you, just because of that dreamer spirit, that ambition, and also because the villain, in quotes, not, you know, the guy in the story. I saw one of the articles you sent us earlier today pointed out that this movie is great because it shows that sometimes the villains do win, you know, temporarily, and, you know, that it'll always be temporarily when they win. And that's mm-hmm. the hope that we have in, you know, the hope we have in Christ tells us that it's temporary win. But he wins, you know, in the end. He gets George Bailey's money and, you know, ha ha ha, he's sitting there next to his fire with his pipe and that's that. But then the community comes together, of course, and backs everything up and, you know, helps George in the end too. So he actually wins. But I just liked that, you know, George, in the face of corruption, held his ground. You know, he never gave an inch to that guy, and I'm totally like blanking on his name, even though I've seen this movie 100 times.
Mr. Potter.
You know,
Mr. Potter.
Yeah, and in the end, he did the, you know, no matter what, he wouldn't choose the easy way out with him, no matter how much that guy kind of tempted him, you know, or whatever. There's, It wasn't like his first choice was never to just hand everything over to him. And having lived through some corporate corruption myself a little bit, I really connect with that too. So for me, I really just love that character. Of course, I love the story of his life. I love his love story, everything, you know, everything about it is great, but especially those two things of his ambitious spirit, struggling with that in the day-to-day, you know, routine of life, and then also standing firm in his own conviction in the face of corruption. Really like that. So that's me.
So is there not something inside you that really wants some kind of justice for Mr. Potter? Like, does it really make the movie that it's just not even a thing? Like, we're not even concerned with making the bad guy suffer. We're more concerned with making the good guy, I don't know,
satisfied.
Yeah, like joyful.
Mm-hmm.
Content.
Oh yeah, I think it needs to be that way, because I think the problem is, and this is very apparent in a lot of film and television today, is making the bad guy suffer, making the bad guy lose hard is our focus. Like, we want to see him go down, and that's pretty evident with worldly events going on right now. Mm-hmm. We want to see the bad guy. Yeah, we do want to see him suffer. And that's kind of our culture, is just like, instead of focusing on the things we should be exalting, we're putting our energy into the destruction of that which we hate, or that which, you know, we want to fight against. And granted, like, you do have to fight against evil, but I like that this movie, Mr. Potter just, you know, lives his life, and that's just that. He keeps doing what he's doing, but George and his community are stronger and better, and they're what the movie ends on them and ends with that hope. And I think I love that this film focuses on that and sort of shows the truth, the reality that, yeah, guys like Mr. Potter are going to win, but yeah, it's a temporary thing and it won't last. And in the end, the love of the family and the community is what triumphed. So I do think, I like the way it is.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why I like this movie a lot. I mean, it goes back to traditions from when I was a kid. My mom and I used to watch old movies together. That was a thing for us growing up, and this was one. This is my mom's favorite movie. I mean, that's her, definitely. She says it all the time. She said it my whole life, and we've watched it a ton because of that. You know, and you grab onto things differently as a kid than you do as an adult. And I always loved Clarence. I mean, Clarence is just so innocent and gracious and sacrificial and eager and funny, you know. I mean, it's just a wonderful performance, and that was always just a lot of fun to watch. I can't say that I feel like we watched this, you know, on TV growing up, because it was on at Christmas. I can't ever say we watched it as a Christmas tradition, but it definitely it feels like that kind of same traditional feel. But yeah, I mean, we always watched it when it was on, and just that part of it. But growing up now, I mean, just especially watching it now, I have a daughter, and I've always really, really loved, my favorite stories are about redemption, and redemption for anybody, but, you know, especially the guy that's just gotten beaten down and has stayed in the face of adversity and evil and unfairness and just life, the crappy parts of life, and still been good to people and just continues to get hammered, and then he does get redeemed in some way. I mean, that's my favorite story in those many forms. And I know there's theological applications to that, but basically the reason why this movie hits so hard is because of that story, because of all the traditions that are inherent within it, all of the beats that it hits for me and family and stuff. But now, I think one of my favorite things in film that I've ever seen, and I have, has much more resonance now for me personally, is Zuzu's Petals. I always loved that as a kid. My mom always loved that. But Frank Capra can just—he could just capture a human moment, just an authentic. There's so much authenticity to that. It's a convention, probably then and especially now, to have some kind of root to the original reality in these kind of fantasy stories. But that one is just so tiny and insignificant, and it grounds him so much that. You know, he becomes a family guy. I mean, this is a character that had huge aspirations, wanted to travel the world, wanted to make lots of money, build things. I'm going to build things. What if I could lasso the moon for you, Mary? I mean, like, that's huge. That's the biggest aspirations you could have. And he ends up what a lot of people would kind of define as settling, but really seeing the magic and the mystery and the wonderful nature of that in his family. And so that really means something to me, and I just, you know, the idea of those tiny things of Zuzu's Petals just meaning so much and grounding him back and just being evidence that of reality is just a really great human moment, and one that I personally just really, it's one of my favorite things ever in film. And so there's a lot of just really great human moments, in the film, and just, it's grounded, and I think people, I think one of the reasons I love stories about of redemption is that it resonates with everybody. Everybody can connect to being down and out in some way, having to fight against something that was unfair or unjust, and just redemption is just a wonderful feeling to hope for and pray for and search for, and I think that's, you know, obviously inherent in the gospel and what we believe, and so I think that's just the essence of human nature is to long for redemption.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I think about both your answers, I'm seeing a lot of the things that I am enjoying about this film. Like, there is a beauty about, that I think we fail to see about the everyday. And we talked about this when we did the Boyhood podcast a long time ago, just like the amazingness, the greatness of the mundane, the possibilities that the everyday has. And that's what I hear a lot of in what you're talking about, Mark. And that's what I love about it, because this film, I think, answers the frustrations that I have in life when I have those frustrations. Like, why am I working at this, you know, the particular job? Like, more than once in my life, I say, why am I at this job, and why I'm not somewhere doing something super awesome and super successful? And I feel legitimately blessed, not like hashtag blessed, but like legitimately, legitimately blessed that I would say the Holy Spirit more than once in my life has revealed to me why I'm in a place. The kind of like on some some understandable level why I am doing something. Not often, you know, kind of hindsight-ish, but helping me understand why I'm in a place. Whether it be like a really good, you know, I'll get done having lunch with a coworker or something, and it was just like this mind-blowingly great lunch where I would have never thought that I would have talked about some of the things or had some things revealed to me or been able to either be or to encourage in a certain way. And those relationships wouldn't exist if I was out conquering the world, you know, building skyscrapers. Like, now maybe there'd be other things, but like, maybe that's the thing that I needed to hear that day. Mm-hmm. Or maybe that's the way that hopefully, like we see, we don't see a lot in this movie of George needing to be in the right place so he gets embedded. Mm-hmm. But we almost see him in every situation being the person who is affecting goodness in people. Mm-hmm. Or betterness in their lives. Mm-hmm. So it would be cool to kind of see some of that. But generally, I'm hoping for that as well. And that's what I feel very blessed to see that I'm making a difference in small ways. Mm-hmm. In whatever situation it is. And it's not always a job. It's a, you know, why am I at a particular church? Why do I find myself in this particular relationship? Mm-hmm. Not in this, you know, not like romantic, but just any relationship. Why am I spending time hanging out with this person when no one else will? Like, I'm such a saint. You know, it's not that, but it's like you have these moments and it's almost magical. Mm-hmm.
You could say it's supernatural.
Supernatural. It's natural. Okay. Almost supernatural. Well, but so that's the other thing. And so I think that the interesting thing is that when I hear you describe the choices that we seem to have, Alexis, mm-hmm. I really, really connect with the idea that we spend a lot of time trying to bring people down. So, and I don't mean that in just like a negative, like everyone's just trying to be negative. It's that, yeah. It's that when someone is wronged, we focus so much on making that, like bringing that person to justice, because rightly we're made in God's image and God desires justice. Now he, you know, his justice is way beyond like our understanding, mm-hmm. in almost every case, mm-hmm. but we are hardwired for justice as well. But we spend so much time fighting for what we see as justice. Mm-hmm. We miss the opportunity to help other people fight for joy.
Yes, mm-hmm. I agree.
And
like 110%.
Yeah. And I think fighting for joy is probably something that we actually can help people do, because I have personal theological feelings about the type and amount of justice that we can actually have
administer.
Kind of administer personally, or even corporately, because I think there's too many things that can kind of go wrong in trying to administer our own justice. Like I said, even with lots of wisdom involved, there's too many things that get in the way of that. But to fight for joy is something that is a lot harder to mess up, mm-hmm. because it's us loving and encouraging and hopefully being bold enough to point people to true joy. Mm-hmm. Which is Christ.
I was going to go to the next thing.
Yeah, like there's...
It's not fighting for happiness.
Yeah, it's not fighting for happiness.
It's fighting for joy, which is very, very different, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, it's like... I was looking up the quote, but I use that quote a lot about... from Khalil Gibran. It's like... I pull it up. I might as well just read it.
Khalil Gibran. That's my man.
Yeah, the deeper...
Lebanese represent.
Yeah. the deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. And it's having that perspective that it's okay that, you know, the thing that's great about this movie, you know, it's not great in terms of typical story arc. It's just great in the fact that it just leaves it that I mean, he doesn't have this, like, the whole movie sets up George Bailey wanting to go on these excursions and go across the world and build all these things to become successful. He never gets there.
Mm-hmm.
He's still, like, you know, working at the bank and loan. You know, he's still, you know, kind of what the story sets up is all these negative things that kind of held him back. You know, most story arcs and that kind of hero's journey or whatever, they push and say, okay, well, he finally gets that success. He finally, but he does, he just looks around and finds that he has joy in his life. Potter doesn't get defeated. There's no justice there for what Potter did by taking mm-hmm. the money. There's no
big, he's not rich.
He's not rich. George Bailey's not rich at the end.
Yeah.
None of that happened. None of that gets undone. All of that kind of sort of negative. He just says, it's okay. It's yeah. whatever that material thing, it's okay because Zuzu, you know, look at my wife, look at my kids, look at my community. And the community comes around and says, we've got your back. You've had our back all of these years. Now it's, mm-hmm. we are able, and that's another great thing about, that's not really explored at all. It's the fact that George is saved from this predicament because of the fact that he gave all these people these opportunities to have some kind of comfortable home and a place to live and be, you know, human and not like, you know, animals in a cage like the Potter's houses, you know, and make their own way as best they can. And that eventually built up a community and built up that way to kind of, you know, help him have some redemption monetarily in that bad situation that he was in. And they don't, you know, they don't really focus on the money. They don't focus on any material. They focus on, it's a wonderful life. Mm-hmm. Life is good. Like, life is okay. It really sucks sometimes because George goes through a lot of bad stuff, but it's like that, you know, Khalil Gibran quote, you know, it's going to carve in you so much space to fill up with joy. Not happiness, because happiness is fleeting, but joy is something that is eternal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What it certainly reminds me, and you know, caveat, I know that we've obviously said that this movie isn't overtly Christian specifically, but it is overtly supernatural. It is overtly spiritual. But mm-hmm. I think it, what it's telling us is straightforward enough that it could have a verse as a theme. And the part, I mean, there are parts where I well up during the film because there's these moments of human interaction that are so beautiful, but I lose it. When Brother Harry shows up at the end,
yeah,
and he says, "A toast to my big brother, George, the richest man in town."
Yeah.
I can't help but thinking of, you know, Potter, who it's odd because I keep wanting to say he stole the money, but it's like stealing by omission. You know, mm-hmm. he didn't technically take the money.
Yeah.
He just failed to give it back. And when I think about wealth and the ability, how easy it is to tear that down, I think of Matthew 6:19-21. Where it says, "Do not store up for yourselves treasure on earth," which is what George wanted to do. Mm-hmm. You know, he said he's going to be rich. He's going to do all this crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He's where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal.
Mm-hmm.
But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. Because Mr. Potter can't take what George Bailey has away.
Right.
For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that. That is a picture of Harry's proclamation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh. Getting emotional.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's...
Well, I thought of that verse, too, actually, as you guys were talking. So it was really good that you chose that. Yeah, I mean, it was... I thought of just treasures in heaven is what I was thinking of.
Yeah.
But, yeah. That's good.
Well, like I said, I would say that's probably why I connect with it. Because I think it's telling us, I think this movie is ultimately proclaiming, it's proclaiming a number of things.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, it's showing us that, you know, politically, socially, and stuff, it's got a number of things to say about the little guy and big business and, you know, coming together and the power of community over the power of greed or the power of power. Mm-hmm. I know it's got a lot of things to say about that, and we could talk about those things for a long time, but I think it hits home when people are convinced, whether they're Christian or not, that there is something better than having money.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is a better use of your time than having a monopoly on an entire town like Mr. Potter wants.
Mm-hmm.
Or that we see Mr. Potter would have eventually done.
Mm-hmm.
In, you know, the Technicolor Potterville.
Yeah.
Or that victory, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean decimating your opponent.
Yeah.
Victory can look different, you know. There's different aspects of victory. I mean,
look at
you
Jesus.
Know, as far as on earth, goes. Obviously, but yeah, there's just different. It's not all about that. It's about the joy. It also reminds me of another Christmas movie, The Who's in Whoville with the Grinch having taken away all their stuff. You know, and their
Is it really a Christmas movie, Alexis?
Oh, that one is really a Christmas movie.
I can watch that movie really any time during the year. And get just as much out of it.
A Christmas movie is in which the plot centers around Christmas. A movie which features Christmas in it is not necessarily.
And it's okay that you're wrong about this. I'm not going to worry about bringing you to justice. I'm going to fight for the joy of enjoying these movies whenever I can.
Oh God. Well, somewhere Gene is cringing at what I just said. So
no, I think Gene's on your side.
Yeah.
Don't
you, Gene?
Wow.
I'm just kidding.
I didn't totally mean, seriously. I obviously meant to make a joke, but I did not mean to totally derail your thought. So please continue.
No, I just meant that, you know, you feel that George is triumphant and joyful, and, you know, he didn't have to hurt anyone to get there. Mm-hmm. He didn't have to be destructive to get there, because there was something higher, you know. I wouldn't say like, oh, something higher helped him along the way. Like, it sounds kind of cheesy when you put it there, but there was a higher calling, a higher way of life. Like I said, he made choices to put others first, you know. And there's some debate. I have a friend who thinks that this movie sort of supports codependency and things like that, because George never really, you know, he doesn't actually take care of himself sometimes or something. That's a whole other debate. But no. I was just like, I can see the point, because Mike, you brought that up a little bit, saying that we would like to see more of the growth in him and not just his effect on others throughout the story. So yeah, I can see that. Well, but as far as he didn't have to hurt other people to make this happen or be selfish. Yeah.
It occurs to me though that, you know, and I think this is the strength of Frank Capra as a director, that Potter is defeated though, because George outlasts him over and over and over for seems like about a period of about 20 years. George outlasts this money machine that literally offers to buy him out and literally tries to take his vision away from him and take, you know, this community, these people away from him. And, you know, there's those moments where he comes so close to, you know, well, let me think about it. Oh, no, wait a minute. I don't need to think about it. You know, Jimmy Stewart.
That was a great impression of Jimmy Stewart. Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. See, that was a great thing about like watching the 40s movie. It's like, all right, now see, they say see a lot for some reason. He does defeat him, I think. And this is really just occurring to me now. Like, it's not a Technicolor defeat. It's not a Potter falls to ruin or George gets all the money from Potter that he, you know.
Or he punches him.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't even get physical
He gets punched.
yeah, he does. And I think that's important because he does defeat him in a much more organic, I think, way. And it's not because, I mean, it's sort of a very human way of looking at victory, like you were saying, Alexis, but in the fact that Potter represents, you know, kind of the bigger machine of money and power that's always going to be there. And so there are many ways to defeat that. And you can't always have that just, you know, earth-shattering defeat that, you know, you win the money and you get the material things. I think it's a very important defeat that Joy outlasts him, community outlasts him. Potter's going to die and George's community is going to continue. So I think that's a valid, you know, point, sort of counterpoint to this idea that George doesn't grow and this codependency idea, which I think is ridiculous. I'm sure your friend's really wrong. I just think it's important to note that he does grow in, you know, understanding what he has created, because the entire time throughout the film, he is kind of lamenting his position, right? He's lamenting where he is and the fact that he just has this good streak in him, but he don't want to be there. He wants to be elsewhere, kind of conquering the world and that kind of thing. And that's why he even considers Potter's offer at one point. So I think that's really a big step for him, is to understand that it doesn't matter. You know, I've got something worth the world, and that is eternal.
Mm-hmm. So absolutely. I would still have a hard time saying that he was defeated, because the thing about this movie is the story's not over.
Well, the story's never over, Viz. I mean, come on.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So, like, defeat has this air of finality to it. Like, you know, like, that's the thing. And that's why I think the story is actually super powerful, because we don't see what happens the next day when they get up. Mm-hmm. Like, sure, they put this deposit in, but, like, he's struggling again the next day to make ends meet, to make sure the building and loan doesn't foreclose.
Yeah.
Potter's still got an extra $8,000 along with all the infinite monies that he had before. He's just going to try to close him down again. He's not defeated, but he, you know, it's a setback.
But that's still still a victory.
But that's the thing. I want to not care at all if he's defeated, because I think it goes back to what I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm even concerned with Mr. Potter being defeated or not, means that I'm spending more time trying to figure out if he got what I think he deserved. And I think that takes away from the fact that it's a much more beautiful, much more fulfilling message to see that George has changed.
Yeah.
And that he is now and has friends and community who are fighting for his joy, mm-hmm. because he's been fighting for theirs. And like I said, that's where I find the beauty. I trolled a little bit when you first, I think, mentioned that you were watching this, or maybe Reed did, and I was talking about how there's plot holes and, you know, yeah. Being very cynical about it. So I watched it and I realized, you know, kind of what we're talking, that is the least important thing in the film. And actually, the more I focus on it, the more I realize it's not that important at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
I think Viz is realizing he's wrong.
No. I wouldn't go that far.
Mark that down.
I'm just saying it's not important. And I think the more we focus on it, it cheapens the message, or it cheapens what we can take away from it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, like I said, I
don't think you guys are disagreeing at all. You know, I think you're on the same page.
Yeah, I think ultimately we're on the same page.
Yeah.
I just. Because at some level, I do think if you had to define a more of a winner and more of a loser, you can do that based on the way the particular film ends. But if you take this as just a snapshot of his life is going to go on another 20 years, and who knows how long Mr. Potter's going to live, like, this isn't over. But I think that's the thing about Joy. Joy is an all the time thing. Mm-hmm. It's not like a place where you're going to get right before you die, or you get when you get to heaven. Like, joy is a thing that you can have yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So I think that's how it's effective in the film.
Absolutely.
Well, there's gratitude too. I think, mm-hmm. Gratitude being a huge theme in this film, and it goes along with joy, because you can't have joy if you're not grateful, if you're not thankful. I mean, thankfulness is just so, you know, such a strong theme of the Bible, and being, you know, especially just being thankful, not just for what you're given, but, you know, thankful for, yeah, what we have in Christ, our victory in Christ, basically. And I think but in this movie, of course, it's more focusing on the gratitude and thankfulness of the everyday, like you mentioned. And that hits home for me too, because being a dreamer and a, you know, person like George Bailey with ambitions as high as lassoing the moon, you know, I can relate to that. So when you are stuck in the muck of the everyday for when you feel that way, it's just, nothing can drag you further down. Like, it's just such a hard thing to go through. So it's like, having that gratitude, if I didn't have gratitude at all ever, or if I never do, it's going to feel like that. Like, I'm trudging and like, mm-hmm. life sucks and there's nothing worth living for or whatever, or not, my dreams aren't coming true. But by gratitude and thankfulness, like George Bailey finds out, you do see that you do have a wonderful life, and I can see the beauty in my everyday things and be so thankful for them. And, you know, just that. And then that's when the joy comes in, when I realize how thankful and how grateful I am, you know, to be in life and in the presence of God, I guess, basically.
Yeah.
That's a little personal, but you know what I mean?
Yeah. That's when you can really stop and look around and really see the collateral beauty.
Oh, man.
Really? You ruined everything. You ruined Christmas.
No.
You ruined
Christmas. No. Will Smith ruined Christmas.
Oh, gosh.
That's kind of true.
You're a mean one, Mr. Smith.
Actually, I think he probably had very... Dude, just wants an Oscar. Can we just give this guy an Oscar?
Just give him an Oscar.
Like...
I'm good with that.
You
should have got it for Concussion then, and not this.
Well, that's the thing.
Ali.
Yeah, Ali. Yeah. That's what you should have got for. Just give the man an Oscar.
I know.
Has he not done enough? It's like waiting for DiCaprio to get one, or like waiting all that, you know, for freaking Denzel to get one or something. I'm like, just give the man a freaking Oscar.
Denzel like, have two now.
He probably does.
Yeah, he's got some.
Yeah, now. did he win for Glory? I think he won for Glory.
No.
And Training Day.
Won for Training Day. He won for
How could he not win for Supporting Actor for Glory?
I could be wrong.
That's correct. Now I gotta look this up.
Really keep up with Google. Academy Awards.
Google. Oh, speaking of Google, I did look up.
You don't, Mark? Okay, 20 points, because I'm against award shows, but anyway.
Oh, no, well, we watch it because it's a reason for us all to hang out.
Right.
And we're building community.
but see, Alexis, she'll probably like Matt Damon's theory on award shows, which is what I tell people every time. He said you really should give awards out 10 years after the movie comes out, because then you've had time to digest it, explore it, really understand it, and then you give out awards 10 years later. You can have that perspective.
That makes sense. I can dig that, yeah, for real. Mm-hmm.
Well, I looked up before what It's a Wonderful Life was based on. It's not based on a book called It's a Wonderful Life. It's based on a short story called The Greatest Gift. The
Greatest Gift, yes.
Short story. I'm like, I knew it was something.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're totally
greatest,
in the ball.
The Greatest Gift, like what, Christmas shoes?
Yes.
It was almost Christmas. Oh, God. Sorry.
What? Oh, my God.
Sorry, Christmas shoes. Christmas Sorry, shoes yeah.
is one of the worst songs.
Have you never heard Christmas Shoes?
Is it a country song?
Oh, no, you've like never heard it. It's a Christian song.
Just don't.
Don't even.
Well, what you can do is what explicit warning? Like,
I'm already laughing, sorry.
You could listen to the Patton Oswalt breakdown of it.
Yeah, Patton Oswalt does a breakdown of Christmas
Shoes.
That
is not an official Real World Theology. Yeah, we can't backing because it's.
Yeah, it's very.
Super not safe for work.
Yeah, it's.
But it's hilarious.
There's some colorful language.
to say the least.
We can't officially endorse it, but if you happen upon it, then yeah. you'll probably laugh. Yeah,
it's real fun.
But off the record, I should.
I would totally
okay, gotcha.
Do it. So
anyway.
Aha! Yes, Denzel Washington, Best Supporting Actor for Glory, also Best Actor for Training Day, and he was nominated for Flight, The Hurricane, Malcolm X, and Cry Freedom.
So. And coming soon, oh my gosh, what's that movie Fences. Called coming up? Fences. Yeah. I don't know what I was going to call that.
Yeah, but does he get nominated for actor or director?
Okay, we're like totally.
Yeah, we're okay. Okay, so let's bring this home because it's our Christmas episode. We're mainly here just to have a little bit of good time, wrap up another great year of the show. So I want to know, It's a Wonderful Life. Any final thoughts that you have, Alexis?
I think if you haven't seen this movie, well, you wouldn't be listening to this podcast. But if you or someone you know may not have seen this movie, definitely watch it. Yeah. Call this hotline. There's definitely, this is a film that, yeah, maybe you saw it maybe when you were a kid and you're like, it was all right. Now watch it again as an adult, especially if you're hashtag adulting and struggling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is something you will resonate with and learn from. And it's definitely the pinnacle of what I would call what a classic movie is because like we talked about, it grows and it stays with you long, you know, long after you've seen it, long after it was created. So
mm-hmm.
I would just highly recommend it. And it's not a Christmas movie anyway.
No. Okay. Well, it is, but that's fine. I like all the stuff you said before then. Mark, anything else that you want to let people with besides it's obviously a Christmas movie?
Yeah, I feel like this might be, you know, not people who haven't seen it, but at this point in the podcast, somebody probably listened to this that, like, has seen it, you know, in the past or mm-hmm. seen bits and pieces over the years. Like, oh, it's on TV. I'll turn this scene on. And I would say watch it from beginning to end because it's really a large portion of the movie doesn't really focus on this, you know, kind of the central conceit of the film that, like,
yeah, the thing that people copy.
Yeah, the thing that people copy is the, like, last quarter of the movie. You know, like something like The Family Man that was just like basically the whole movie is usually him getting a different look on his life if he didn't exist mm-hmm. or if he had another alternative life. That's at the end. The whole build-up is long, and I feel like a lot of people don't watch this every year because it is kind of a long movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's over 2 hours, but having. For this, I actually sat down and I watched it front to back. And that buildup makes that last quarter of the movie just hit so much harder.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage, you know, this is 2016. This has been a really bad year for a lot of different reasons for people.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Except for Cubs fans.
I mean,
the Thistles who had a kid.
And the Thistles who have a kid. That's why I said a lot of people, not everybody.
Yeah.
But a lot of people, you know, it's been a difficult year, and even if you're looking at just the climate in general, it's a tumultuous one. This is a film that can remind you about a lot of good things. It doesn't, you know, make everything okay. It doesn't, you know, have these magical powers to turn things better, but it will really kind of give you a good perspective on what we've talked about, joy and kind of how that plays into sorrow and life and the things that really make it wonderful. And so I would just say give it a full watch if you can make the time for it, and just soak it in because it really has a wonderful human touch, organic touch to it that a lot of movies are missing sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so just give it that full gut punch and just watch the whole thing and just see how it makes you respond to the current climate.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, it adds one thing to the couple things that I wanted to say.
Okay.
And,
okay.
I want to be clear in the contrast that we've made, about joy and justice that I don't think yearning for justice is a bad thing.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
I don't think it necessarily came across that way, but I think yearning mm-hmm. for justice and hoping for justice and working for justice, especially Especially that's working. That's what I'm saying. Like with what especially you're just saying, working, yeah. With the climate that we're in, I think working for justice is a very worthwhile cause. Mm-hmm. I would just try to do that with wisdom, realizing there are sometimes better ways to spend our time than.
Well, and yeah, I mean this side of heaven, justice is incomplete. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be hard, but it is, if, you know, to have that contrast of joy, mm-hmm. understanding that joy is a worthwhile effort, especially to go alongside justice.
Yeah.
Because justice is a hard fight.
Yeah.
Very worth it. And especially if you can find that joy and work towards that as well.
I would go as far to say the more joy, the more true Christ-inspired joy that you have in your life, the better and more true the justice you can work for will be.
100%.
Because it won't be tainted by things that joy pushes out. Mm-hmm. So that's one final thought. Two is definitely a change of tone. It's, I'm sitting there watching towards the end of the movie, and George Bailey's like, Bert, Ernie, Bert, Ernie. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm having a revelation. And I Googled it, and I found that Bert and Ernie were actually named after Bert and Ernie in It's a Wonderful Life. At least that's what Google tells me.
No way.
So it says that it has been stated in numerous articles, websites, and television shows that Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street were named after two characters from the film It's a Wonderful Life. Bert the policeman and Ernie the cab driver.
Yeah.
How about that's that? Hilarious.
And so,
as George Bailey would say, what do you know about that?
So that was two. And my third is something, I save it for three because my thinking on it is incomplete. But having done this for a couple years now, I'm starting to think more about story and structure and how a film starts and ends than I have, you know, I did before. And like I said, I don't think I saw this movie since I've really given a lot of thought. And I was really just kind of floored by this idea, again, incomplete, so I'm not sure where to go with it, but just something to think about. But we start the film with George Bailey as a kid. The first act of kindness that we see is him jumping into icy cold waters to save somebody. And that sets his life on a trajectory to where he's ready to end it until he jumps into icy cold waters to save somebody. Mm-hmm. And it actually ends up saving his life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's kind of messing with my brain a little bit. to just see like him doing the same action. And once, it basically set him on his path. And the second time it redeemed the path that he'd been on the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Amazing how like water and baptism.
Exactly.
And you go down, you come up a different person.
Like I said, just, it's little things like that, that I'm just like, I don't see that very often.
I really think that it's just a human element that's the brilliance of Frank Capra. Mm. It's just to kind of connect stuff like that. That's a good director.
Well, the only other thing I had was try to work in more Collateral Beauty references, but I think I did that well earlier. So
the subhead of then, again, I think I figured it out, is It's a Wonderful Life and that time that Gene died hard.
Yeah, died hard. Oh, it's so layered. No. I really enjoyed this conversation. Like I said, there are plenty of other aspects, social, political, kind of cultural conversations that are happening and that you can basically pick out of 1946 and plant right into 2016.
Yeah.
So I encourage mm-hmm. everyone to have these conversations. Have them at our discussion group on Facebook. We would love to continue talking about it. But this conversation was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I almost always forget how much I enjoy talking about a Christmas movie every year, which this is obviously. So great conversations happen because of great guests. So I want to make sure that the listeners have a chance to, like, again, interact with you guys, because, like I said, I think y'all are smart and have a lot of cool things to say. So, Alexis, how can people find the work you do on the web or interact with you?
Well, I'm definitely, I lean towards Twitter, and my handle is at Phoenician Rises. That's PhoenicianRises. And that's definitely where I like to talk the most as far as like interaction about culture, film, and television. So you can find me there. I pop up on Real World Theology occasionally, you know, and I'm in the group too. So you can find me there and read some of my stuff on the website. I think that's it for now.
Nice. Mark, same thing. How can people find either you socially or your work?
Socially, I'm the most interactive on the Facebook group that we have, the Real World Discussion Group. And then, you can find me most active also on realworldtheology.com. Most recently, we did a Moral Dilemma Dialogue, which was a lot of fun, on the movie Ex Machina. That's something to go check out. Me and Blaine took pretty interesting approaches to that one, and all kinds of stuff going on over there. So I'm pre-plugging your next plug, Fizz.
Excellent. You can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. And as I've said, go to search for the Real World Theology Discussion Group on Facebook. We have almost anyone who's ever been involved with the show in that group, chatting about movies, trailers, ideas, themes. It's a lot of fun. So connect with us any way you can. Like I said, Alexis and Mark are doing great work. They are a lot of fun to banter with. So I would encourage you to do such things. I would also encourage you to, you know, give back this season. Subscribe to a podcast. Subscribe specifically to this podcast.
Give out stars.
Yeah, so get like star ratings. 'Tis the season for giving, you know?
Yes.
We are giving you this great content. You should give us 5-star reviews.
Oh my gosh.
Seriously, you know, it always helps to have more subscribers. Getting more people involved in the conversation is a lot of fun. But for now, for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz. I'm wishing all of you who have listened to or contributed to another great year a very Merry Christmas. And I hope that you'll start your 2017 by spending more time fighting for joy.
Amen.
We'll see you again all very soon. Thank you. And we end the year.
Oh, wait.
Wait, what, huh?
George Bailey, I'll love you to the day I die. Sorry, I just wanted to say that.
Well, then we will now properly end, formally end the year, like we end every episode. Like we'll end this episode by reminding everyone that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, everybody!
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Merry Christmas, building and loan!
Yeah.